James 2:14 through 2:26, Faith and Works, the fourth talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits, was presented by Ron Julian on October 21, 1997, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Well, as I said when we were talking earlier, the passage that we're going to be looking at tonight is a very important one to me, and one of the first ones that I really took on myself to try to understand what's going on. There's this tension, seemingly, between what we find in Paul, in Romans, say, which you guys have been talking about the last several weeks, and what we find in James. Let me read the passage. We're not going to be able to look at this whole passage in detail tonight because there's a lot to it. But let me read you the passage that we're talking about. We're in James chapter 2, and the section we're concerned with is verses 14 through 26. James 2, 14 through 26. What use is it, my brethren, if a man says he has faith, but he has no works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? Even so, faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. But someone may well say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without the works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that God is one. You do well. The demons also believe and shudder. But are you willing to recognize, you foolish fellow, that faith without works is useless? Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered up Isaac, his son, on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. And he was called the friend of God. You see that a man is justified by works, and not by faith alone. And in the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works, when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? For just as the body without the spirit is dead, so also faith without works is dead. Well, I don't know if you're familiar with the tension, the potential problem here, but let me remind you of something that Paul says in Romans 3. He says, for we maintain that a man is justified by faith, apart from works of the law. And James in 2:24 says, you see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. And as I mentioned earlier, to me, this tension between these two verses always seemed like really terrible news, because the most important question that you could confront is, who is the one who is justified before God? To be justified is to be accepted, to be forgiven. The one who is justified is the one who is in the right with God. There isn't any more important question that I could face than, who is the one who is in the right with God? And Paul and James seem to be saying 180 degrees around exactly opposite things about who is right with God. Paul seems to be saying that we are saved in spite of our works, and James seems to be saying that we are saved because of our works. And naturally, if you're anything like me, you prefer Paul's version to James, because if you're at all familiar with your works, you might want to prefer Paul's to James. So what we want to talk about tonight is this passage in James. What is James saying? We want to look carefully as carefully as we can in the time that we have to see what specifically is he getting at. What is he saying and what is he not saying? Because, I mean, obviously, it's probably obvious that I'm going to maintain that there is actually no tension between Paul and James, that what both of them are saying is true, and the two things that they are saying fit together very well. There is no contradiction, I would say. But a number of people have made that claim, and if you've ever looked at the various commentaries on James or heard people teach on them, they don't always explain how you put the two together in the same way. So part of what I want to do tonight is begin to set things up so that you can understand what I think is a reasonable and the reasonable way to understand how James and Paul fit together. And we want to do that by examining James' argument in this passage. But having said all of that stuff, the fact is I want to start, before we look at James, I want to tell you a story. And I admit beforehand that this little analogy that I'm going to make, you can't press too far, and I don't want you to press it too far, but I just want, before we get started looking at the argument of the passage, I want to show you what I think is something of the key to understanding how James and Paul are speaking. So I want to tell you a story. Once upon a time, there was a great chess player. This is the greatest chess player that the world has ever known. He never lost a game. He won every game that he played. On one occasion, he played blindfolded against 1,000 grandmasters. And he won every game. So this is phenomenally great chess player. The world has never seen a chess player like this and never will again. He was a very reclusive man, and he took to never appearing in public. He always stayed up in his little loft and never came down. His name was Theo. One day, Theo announced that he was starting an exclusive chess club. Chess players from all over the world gathered together because they really, really wanted to join this chess club that Theo was starting. And Theo sent out his representative named Moses. This representative came out and explained to everybody how it is you get into this chess club. In order to join this chess club, it's very easy. All you have to do is duplicate Theo's feat. You have to have never lost a game of chess, and you have to be able to play blindfolded against 1,000 grandmasters and win every game. Well, this was very discouraging to those who had wanted to join the chess club because there wasn't anybody else in the world who could even come close to matching Theo's accomplishment. So this was a very, very exclusive chess club in that there were no members because nobody qualified. Okay, so everyone was really excited, therefore, when Theo sent out another representative down the line. This representative was named Paul. Paul said, "Theo has a new offer to make to y'all. Anyone can become a member, no matter how poorly they play chess. You can be a terrible chess player, and you can still join this club. The only qualification is that you have to love the game of chess in order to get in." Now, people now are coming from all over the world to join Theo's club. It's the most exclusive club in the world, not because that it was only good chess players, but because this was the club that had been started by Theo, the greatest chess player in the world. Everybody wanted to be in Theo's club. You have to picture this huge house that he has. He never comes down. He's always up in the attic somewhere. Nobody ever sees him. But this house is strewn with chess boards, everybody huddled over the chess boards playing chess. There's a big sign on the wall: "No matter how poorly you play, anybody can join." So one day, there's a guy sitting at a chess board playing chess. While he's waiting for his partner to move, he would talk loudly to the other players, disrupting everybody in the place. He would pick up the chess pieces when it wasn't his turn, and he would pick at them and break off the little carved edges on the pieces. He would tell rude jokes, like, "How many chess players does it take to screw in a light bulb?" Or, "What, what do you call 10 chess players at the bottom of the ocean, or like that. Every time he moved a piece, he would complain and grumble and talk about how much more sense checkers made than chess. Okay, so one, he's sitting there playing this game. Another one of Theo's representatives, named James, comes along and tells him he has to leave. He can't be a member in this club anymore. And he says, what are you talking about? I mean, James comes up to him and he says, I'm sorry, we don't like the way you're playing. He says, what do you mean? He points up to the motto on the wall. It says, no matter how poorly you play. How, what do you mean you don't like the way I play? Paul said that I could be a member of this club no matter how badly I played the game. And so Paul, standing over in the corner, hears this, and he comes over and he says, now what's the problem here? And this guy's James says I have to leave because I'm not playing the game well. He says, but you said that I could stay no matter how poorly I played. And Paul comes along and says, now look, you didn't understand what I was talking about. There are two issues here, not just one. One issue is how skillfully do you play the game? But the other issue is, do you love to play chess or not? Now, what did I say it took to be a member in this club? I said that Theo would accept anyone as a member, no matter how crummy he was at playing chess. And that's right. But I also said that the qualification was, you have to love the game. Now, when you're playing, out there playing a game of chess, you're showing me both things about yourself. Yeah, you're showing me whether you're a good chess player or not, that's true. But I've been watching you play. You also are showing me whether you love the game or not. And I'm telling you, anybody that plays the game by disrupting everybody else, breaking the pieces, making rude jokes about chess players, is not somebody who loves the game. The way you're playing the game shows me that you don't meet the qualification, which is not that you be a great chess player, but that you love the game. So you have to leave. Now, I mean, obviously, I'm set this story up for a particular reason. It seems to me that there are two issues that we face when it comes to the question of who is it that inherits salvation. One of them is, how well do I play the game? That is, when we come to the standard of goodness that we find in God, do I meet that standard or not? The other issue is, am I a believer? Do I believe and embrace the truth of the gospel? So what does it take to get into the salvation club? Well, do I have to be morally perfect to get into the salvation club? No. That's what Paul meant when he talked about being justified by faith apart from works of the law. The gospel is a promise that my sins will not be held against me. The fact is, I am a sinner. I am not morally perfect, but I am accepted before God in spite of that fact. But there's another issue. And we could describe this, the Bible describes this in many ways. Do I have faith? Do I love God? Do I long for the kingdom of God? And there's a whole bunch of different phrases that we could use that I think the Bible uses, which are not phrases that are asking, are you morally perfect? I'm not morally perfect, and they are not demanding that I'm morally perfect. But they are saying that there are two kinds of people in the world. Those who hear the promises of God and are drawn to them and say, yes, I believe them and I want what it is you have promised. And those who, in one way or another, are hostile or indifferent to those promises. Now, the key idea to understand is that my works, how I behave, how I live my life, show both of those aspects of me. That is, if you look at the way I live my life, you will see whether or not I am a sinner. And just to break the suspense, I am. I know it's so hard to tell, but the fact is that I am a morally imperfect person, and that's what I understand you to be as well. My works, how I behave, my impatience, my lack of consideration, my preoccupation with my needs over other people's needs, and a whole raft of things that we could look at, show that I am not morally even close to anywhere in the same league as the president, the founder of this club. But how I behave shows something else about me as well. How I behave shows what I believe, what I value. What I do in life says something about what do I want? What do I believe is true? What do I think is valuable and important? Now, what I want to say basically, before we look at the details of the text itself, is that what's happening in James is that James is coming along to a group of people who have made a profession of faith. They hang around together in groups and call themselves Christians. But many of the people that he's writing to, he's deeply concerned about that what he sees in the way they're living doesn't seem to match up with what they say they believe. Now, how is that specifically? We'll talk about that a little later, and that's something that you really have to study the whole book of James to kind of get that picture. But let's just put it out there right now that there's something about the way they're living that he's saying doesn't match up. He's not saying you've claimed to be morally perfect people, but I see sin. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is you've claimed to be believers, but I see nothing but unbelief in the way you live. When Paul talks about works, he's talking about works of righteousness, those works that would demonstrate that I deserve to be saved. And he's saying, I can't be saved on that basis. God is not going to save me on the basis of my works, in the sense that I'm going to demonstrate how worthy I am to enter into eternal life. Because I am not worthy, and my works show everyone that I'm not worthy. James is not talking about earning salvation or anything like that. What he's saying is, faith is something that it has a reality in the heart. Being a believer is different from being an unbeliever. And it's so different that ultimately you're going to see the difference in the way people live. And what I see in you guys, not you guys, but James is saying to you guys that I'm writing to, what I see is people who are saying, I believe, and who are living, I don't believe. That's what the book of James is all about, is basically calling them back, basically saying, look, I'm asking you to really believe this. That's what this section about faith and works that we're looking at tonight is all about. When he says that faith without works can't save, what he's basically saying is, I hear you saying that you believe and you would answer true, you know, is Jesus the Messiah? Yes, I'd say that. Did he raise from the dead? Yes, he did. You know, and we could list the doctrines that they would have been willing to say that they believe. But the fact is, those beliefs hadn't really made it into the way they actually thought about life and lived life. So, having said all that, that's where I think we're going. That's what I think this passage is about. I want to take you in particular to what I think is the most important part of this section, at least. We'll have time to talk about that and probably not much more. So I want to jump into the middle of this a little bit. We're in 2:21. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected, and the scripture was fulfilled, which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. Very, 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 very important passage as far as I'm concerned. Very, very important. This whole section is very important in understanding biblical theology, I think, and that little section right there is the kernel, the nucleus at the heart of it. In order to understand what's happening here, though, I think we're going to have to talk a little bit about Abraham. Because the interesting thing, I don't know if you've ever actually looked into this at all, but the fact is that Paul and James, in these very sections where they seem to be contradicting each other, both of them refer to the same passage about Abraham in Genesis. Genesis 15:6. And Abraham believed in God, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. Genesis 15:6. Paul quotes it and says, "See, we're justified by faith." And James quotes it and says, "See, we're justified by works." Now, that we've got to look at that. I mean, that's something we have to be able to sort out. So, let me take you to then the story of the life of Abraham, just briefly, because we're not going to be able to understand this if we don't look at Abraham. And in general, I might point out to you that it is always a very good idea in studying the Bible, if you're studying the New Testament and the New Testament authors makes a reference to something in the Old Testament, it is always, always, always a good idea to go and actually look at the thing in the Old Testament that the New Testament author is talking about. Go and look at it and make sure you understand what it's talking about so that you can then see what the New Testament author is doing with it. If we don't do that, we can very easily come to bad conclusions because we're being too simplistic. We're not going back and making sure that the conclusion we're coming to fits the text in the Old Testament that's being talked about. Okay. You don't have to turn to all these passages because we're going to dance through several passages in the Old Testament. But in Genesis 12, we see a very, very important passage. It's part of why this passage in James is important. The story of Abraham is very significant, and what James has to say about it is very significant. In Genesis 12, we read, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." We anymore refer to that statement as the Abrahamic covenant, the covenant which God made with Abraham, the promise that he made to Abraham that he would make a great nation of him, give a land to him, that he would bless him, and that he would bless all of the families of the earth through him. Very, very important statement. Paul in Galatians says that in that statement, "In you all the families of the earth shall be blessed," he says Abraham had the gospel preached to him. Essentially, Paul sees that that's like the very first kind of hints we see in the Old Testament of something that God intends to do for the world. It's going to have something to do with Abraham, and it's going to be a blessing that comes to all the families of the world, not just the Jews, not just the descendants of Abraham, but all the nations of the world. So, very important statement. Abraham is given this promise. So, Abraham picks up and moves, as he's told to do. After he has gone off and been involved in a great battle and various interesting things have happened, God comes to him and says to him, "Do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great." And this is in Genesis 15. And basically what Abraham says to him is, "Look, God, I hear what you're saying about how you're going to bless me. I remember, you know, several years ago you made a promise about this blessing and it involved becoming a great nation and all of that kind of stuff. How's that going to happen? How am I going to become a great nation? I don't have any kids." I mean, you got to have at least one kid to found a nation. You cannot found a nation with nobody. If I die off and there are no descendants from me, that's the end of any nation as far as I'm concerned. So God tells him at this spot, "Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this man that he had referred to will not be your heir, but one who shall come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir." And so God promises to Abraham, "You know, this promise that I made to you, that a great nation would come from you, that's going to happen through a descendant coming directly from you. You are going to be a father. And that child will be the one through whom I fulfill the promises that I've made to you." So now Abraham knows, okay, God has promised, I'm going to have a kid. After having heard that promise, Genesis 15:6, "Then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. After Abraham is told specifically, you're going to have a kid through your body and your descendants will be like the stars and the sands of the sea and so on, Abraham believes that promise, and what we read is essentially God justifies Abraham. God accepts Abraham, sees him as right in his eyes because he believed this promise that God had made to him. Paul quotes this passage and says, look, Abraham didn't work to earn God's justification. That is, it's not that Abraham was a morally perfect person who never sinned. God didn't accept him because he was a morally perfect person. He accepted him because he believed the promise that God had made to him. That's what Genesis 15:6 is saying. God reckoned it to him as righteousness that he believed this promise. Paul doesn't go any further in his discussion. He stops there. But if we're going to understand what James does with this passage, we have to go on in Abraham's life because there's more to it. Okay. Abraham, and we can debate. What happens is, Abraham's wife says to him, look, I'm not going to have a kid, so why don't you sleep with my handmaiden, and she can have a kid, and then we'll count that as mine. So he does, and he has a kid, and the son is named Ishmael. So now, if you're in Abraham's position, you think, God said that a son from my own body would be my heir, would fulfill this promise that God had made to me. So Ishmael, he could be it. This could be the kid who's going to fulfill what God had said. So in Genesis 17, Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. And I think we need to understand that this live before thee is, it's like saying that Ishmael might be in your favor. That Ishmael, in other words, might be the promised child who receives all the blessings and who brings about the blessings that you promised. But God said, no, but Sarah your wife shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. Now see how significant this is. Abraham thought, I already have a kid, maybe this is the kid who's going to be the one. God tells him, no, your wife, who is old and barren, is going to bear you a son, and that son will be named Isaac. So, if we kind of look at the progression that moves along, we have the promise, and then Abraham asks the question, how's this going to come about? And he's told, a son from your body. And then Abraham thinks, okay, is it going to be Ishmael? God says, no, through Sarah, named, the kid will be named Isaac. So, at this point, Abraham has very specific information about what it is God has promised to do. He's moved step by step to a fairly detailed understanding. It is at this point that the great turning point in Abraham's life happens. After Isaac is born, and so the miracle happens, his old and barren wife has a son, they name him Isaac, God comes to Abraham, and it says, God tested Abraham. Tested Abe. Okay. What does he do? He comes to him and says, basically, look, Abraham, I want you to take your son up the top of a mountain, and I want you to offer to him to me as a burnt offering on the mountains. Now, we'll talk in a minute about what the nature of this test is. Abraham does it. He's stopped by the angel of the Lord at the last moment, so he doesn't actually have to do it, but he was willing to do it. He was raising the knife to kill his son. God stops him, and then he says, very significantly, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." Now, I hope you can see how significant that statement is, because God had promised earlier all that stuff, you know, blessing to the nations and great the seed and all of that. This is stuff that Abraham had been promised before. There weren't any conditions put on it before, but now God is saying, because you obeyed me, because you did what I told you to do, I'm going to bless you in the way that I promised that I was going to bless you. And the question is, how does that work? One of the questions we might want to ask Paul is, hey, Paul, when you told us that Abraham didn't work to earn that justification before God, how come you didn't come to this passage in Genesis 22 where it says, where God says, because you obeyed me, you're going to get this stuff? How come you didn't bring us to that passage, Paul? Well, in essence, James has brought us to this passage. What James is saying essentially is the same thing that the angel of the Lord said to Abraham, if we can get in and see how that is. And that's what we want to look at. The key is this, I would argue. What is the nature of this test? Many of you have heard me talk about this before, but I think this is very important. We often get the idea, I think, that the test of Abraham was somehow, I mean, what it would seem like to me is God's going to come up with the most awful, horrendous, disgusting thing that he could think of to ask me to do, and then he's going to see if I'm willing to do it or not. You know, Ron, are you willing to take a baby and XYZ and I guess so, if you say that I have to. That's not what the test of Abraham is all about. The Bible tells us what the testing of Abraham was all about, and it's not about that. Think about what had happened in Abraham's life as he goes along. He knows at this point, when God comes along and says, I want you to offer up Isaac, he knows that Isaac is the child of promise. Isaac is the one that is going to fulfill all the promises that God made to Abraham. He was told, a son through Sarah named Isaac. This is the kid. Not only had God promised that he was going to bless Abraham, but he promised to bless him specifically through the child that was there on the altar that God was saying, I want you to kill him. Essentially, what God is saying is, that child through whom I promised to fulfill a great promise to you, to bless the nations, and so on, I want you to give him back. I gave him to you, I want you to give him back to me. Lest you think that I'm just making that up, I want to point out what I think is a very significant passage in Hebrews chapter 11:17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, in Isaac your descendant shall be called. He considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. Okay, now, look at what he's pointing to here, what he's getting at. Here, God tests Abraham. He says, I want you to kill Isaac. But he's saying, Abraham is the one who had earlier heard the promise that Isaac, as he quotes there, in Isaac your seed shall be called. he had been given the promise that Isaac was the one who was going to fulfill the promise. So why is it that Abraham is willing to kill Isaac? He's willing to kill Isaac because he believes that God is going to have to give him back, that he's going to have to raise him from the dead, because God had promised Isaac has to grow up and have kids in order for this promise to work. He hasn't had any kids yet, so this is not Isaac's time to die. It can't be Isaac's time to die if God is going to be faithful to the promise that he had made. So, now it's true, the author of Hebrews is saying something that we don't see in the Genesis text. That statement about he thought that God would bring him back from the dead, it doesn't say that in the Genesis text. But what it does say is that God tested Abraham. And I would argue as if we follow the story through, we can see that what the author of Hebrews is saying makes perfect sense. Abraham is not being asked to kill Isaac in the sense of, I want you to kill him, he's gone, no more Isaac. Abraham is being asked to believe that God is going to keep the promise that he made. So the test, when he was asked to offer Isaac up, is really about the promise way back here and the promise that he was told about here. God tests Abraham, seeing whether he believes what he said he believed. What did it say? In fact, let's just keep this one out of it and go back to this. Back here, God promised, and what does it say? Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. But belief that God is faithful, that God is going to keep the promises that he had given, that belief was tested down here. Abraham, do you trust God? Abraham, do you in fact believe that he is going to use Isaac to fulfill the promise that he said he would? Well, let's find out. Give him back. Give him back to me. You've got him now, but I want you to give him back to me. So we can find out whether you believe that I will in fact use him to bless you the way I said I would. Well, as we know, he never actually, I mean, he didn't harm a hair on Isaac, but he was willing to do it because he believed what God had promised back here. This is what the author of Hebrews is saying. Abraham did this. He offered up Isaac, what does he say? By faith. It was by faith that he offered him up. Not just blind obedience, okay, God said I have to do it, so I have to do it. It's, no, I believe God. He promised something to me, and in this choice that I face as to whether I'm going to kill Isaac, I am confronting the question of whether I believe him or not. The author of Hebrews says it is his faith that brings him to offer up Isaac. Well, I would say then that's exactly what James is saying. So I think now we're in a position to understand the passage in James 2. What James says becomes clear here. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. Now let's just talk about that. His faith, it says, was working with his works. That, and I think you can see what he's getting at there. What he did was going hand in hand with what he believed. It was because he believed the promise that he did what he did. It says that his works perfected his faith. And this is a difficult word because we tend to misunderstand it in English. We tend to think that if something's perfect, it means, you know, it's without flaw of any kind. It is morally pure. But when he says his works perfected his faith, you have to go back and kind of look at this Greek word and see the way that it tends to get used. But what he's getting at is, look, back here, Abraham heard a promise and he believed it. But it was all internal. You know, he heard it and he said, okay, yeah, I'll buy that. I believe that. I'll go for that. But he hadn't really yet come to grips with, what does this really mean? Do I really believe this? How strongly do I believe this? You know, what is this all about? When he had to act on it, when he had to look at this choice and say, am I going to do this or not? That's when his faith was perfected, that it matured, it moved out into the realm of action, where he actually had to do something about it. And then he says his works, what he did here, fulfilled the passage which says Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Again, if we look at this, when did it say that God justified Abraham? Back here, when the promise was given. James is saying a kind of a strange thing. He's saying that what Abraham did here in offering up Isaac fulfilled what it said way back here. What it said way back here was Abraham believed God. And he was accepted because of that. But what kind of a faith was that Abraham had when he believed God? Did God pass out a true-false test, and Abraham said, yes, okay, I do believe I'm going to have a kid, and then he passed it in, and God looked at it and said, that's the right score, you get an A. No, the kind of belief that he had was that kind of belief as in, this is true, this is important, I believe this, I'm going to act on this, I'm going to live as if this were true. That's the kind of faith that he had. Well, when is it that the implicit promise in that statement, Abraham believed God, when do I see that really coming to its fruition? I see it being fulfilled when Abraham is willing to give Isaac back. When he's willing to give him back, that's showing the belief in the promise that he had here in action. And then the last statement of importance there is that statement that says, you see that faith was working with his works. Okay, no. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? All that we've just been describing, James uses the language to say he was justified by his works. But when we look at the whole picture that James is painting, we can see what he's doing. He's not denying what it said back here. He quotes what it says back here about Abraham being justified by his faith. He was right before God because he believed the promise. That's why. But what kind of a faith was it that justified him? It was the kind of a faith that was so real that when it came time to act on it, he did. And so when he says he was justified by works, what he means is he was justified by a faith that led him to do something, as opposed to a faith that did not ever lead him to do anything. And what James wants to argue in this whole passage is, I don't think you can be justified by a faith that never has any impact on the way you act. He says, what kind of a faith is it? You tell me, I believe. You know, I say to you, you know, the bridge is rotten. If you step on it, you'll fall through to your death below. And as you go walking out on the bridge, you say, oh, I believe you. I really do. I mean, no, you don't. I mean, you just showed that you didn't believe it in what you did, even though you were saying the whole time that you did. You know, we have that saying that says, actions speak louder than words. That's the kind of thing that James is getting at. He's basically saying, I hear what you're saying about what you believe, but your actions in life, and we could number among their actions selfish ambition, greed, jealousy, murder. I mean, he's saying, when I look at what you're doing, I have a hard time understanding what you mean when you say, I believe. That's essentially what's happening in this section. The key, I think, to understanding this, the whole section here, that is to see in the story of Abraham the model of how having a particular belief is ultimately going to have an effect on the way you behave. Abraham's obedience was not just obedience. It was living out acting out the beliefs that he had said he had earlier. Now, you and I have not been called upon to sacrifice children on an altar, and my children are very appreciative of that fact. But the fact is, we face the same issue. In the gospel, we have been given promises, and we have been given statements about reality that we as Christians would say, that's true. Jesus is the Messiah. He is coming back to bring in an eternal kingdom of righteousness. He died on the cross for my sins. And various statements that we would say, those are true doctrines. What James is trying to say is that just like with Abraham, what he believed he had to face into in a choice that he made in life, what we say we believe in the gospel confronts us with choices in this life as well. Sooner or later, I'm going to have to make some decisions in my life based on whether I believe the story of the gospel or not. Do I really believe that I'm a sinner? Or do I think I'm, you know, basically okay? You know, I'm a good guy. Do I believe that God exists? Or do I think he's pretty negligible and I can pretty much cruise on through life without paying much attention to him? Do I believe that there is a life after this one where the king of the universe, Jesus, is going to come and rule over a kingdom in which righteousness reigns? Do I believe that that is where true life and true fulfillment can be found, and it can be found nowhere else? That's what the gospel tells me. Now, the question that I face in my life is, do I believe those things to be true? The book of James is a book that talks a lot about the testing of faith. Abraham was tested, he says in this passage, but he starts out the book by saying that we all get tested. Somewhere along the line, each of us has to face the question, do I believe this is true or not? And I face that question in part in how I behave. Now, I want to just step out of that for a second to make a qualification, which is very important to me. Remember what I said in the beginning, the story about the chess club. You could be a member of that chess club and play crummy chess. Well, the fact is that you can be a citizen in the kingdom of God and still be a morally struggling sinner. So the works that your life shows, how you behave, how you live, are going to demonstrate the fact that you are not a perfect person. That does not disqualify you from a place in the kingdom of God. It does not demonstrate that you are not a believer. That's not what James is saying. That's how we have to put Paul and James together. I am accepted in spite of the fact that I am not good enough to earn a place in the kingdom of God. So, if I see weakness in myself, which I do, if I see works in my life which are sometimes foolish, which are sometimes unbelieving in the sense that my faith is very weak and I do things out of fear or self-protection or whatever that don't seem to match what I say I believe in the gospel, that's not what James is talking about either, I would argue. And we would have to look through the whole book to make sure, to make clear that that's what's happening. All of us are hypocrites at times. Sin makes all of us hypocrites at times. Every bit of sin is an implicit sort of denial of the things that we say we believe in the gospel. So all of us are hypocrites up to a point. But the biblical picture, as I see it, tells me that there is a place, nonetheless, there is a reality to this thing called faith that actually makes a difference. It doesn't make me perfect, but it does make me different. Some of those differences the Bible would describe as being willing to confess that I am a sinner and mean it, to be humble before God and say, I do not deserve your kindness. To be one who has looked at the promises of the kingdom of God and said, that's what I want. That's what I want my life to be about. To be growing into that, at least. My life changes because my values change. My commitments change. I believe that it is significant that although at this point in my life I, with great sadness, have to report that I am still a sinner, I'm very serious about that, I believe that it is true that I do not want to be one anymore. That is not what I want for my life. I want what the redemption, the rescue, which God has promised in the gospel. That's different from where I used to be. And I think it is that kind of difference which James is pointing to. The people that he's writing to, as he's going to go on to describe in later sections, they're not repentant about their sinfulness. They're rejoicing in it. What they ought to be ashamed of, they're laughing about. It's that which he's pointing to say, you know, I don't understand how you can say you believe the gospel and yet totally put aside the promises of the gospel and be out there stabbing everybody in the back in your efforts to grab some little piece of turf for yourself. He says, that doesn't match. If you believe that you can't keep anything in this world and it is only the promise of the eternal kingdom of God that is something that you can hold on to, if you believe, as the gospel says, that the true riches are the riches to be found in God's kingdom, then why are you out there stabbing everybody in the back trying to get whatever you can? How do those two things go together? So, the theme, the thing that James wants to get across to the people that he's writing to is, this gospel that you say you believe when you get together on Sunday and you sing the songs and you listen to the teaching and then you go home, if you in fact actually believe it, it's going to make a difference. It's going to have an impact. You're going to believe it on Monday as well, and even on Wednesday, and then maybe even on Thursday. You're actually going to keep believing it, and it's going to make a difference. That's what the testing of your faith is partly all about, he says in the first chapter. Part of the purpose God has for testing our faith is, as he said in this section, to perfect it, to bring it to maturity, to move it from that theoretical thing in my head to something that I had to act on and think about and wrestle with. That's what God does. That's what the book of James is about, I think. So if we come back then, now obviously we don't have time to talk about a number of the other details in this passage. I wanted to concentrate on Abraham because I think he's the key to seeing it. In the question time, I'll take any questions you have about any of the verses in that section. But if we come back to that question of Paul and James, how do they fit together? It seems to me that they fit together very well. Because Paul is saying to his readers, look, don't listen to the legalists. Don't listen to those ones out there who want to convince you that you can earn a place in God's favor by keeping the law. You're not good enough to earn a place in God's favor by keeping the law. What you need to do is confess that you're a sinner and believe in the promise of forgiveness that is to be found in Jesus. If you will do that, then you will be forgiven and you will be saved. What James is coming along to say is, yeah, that's right. Faith in the promises that God has made, that's how you find justification. But faith is the sort of thing that if it's a real and genuine faith, it has an impact on the way you live. It isn't possible to believe something, to sincerely believe something, and not have it affect the way you live. Even if at times you act out of keeping with what you believe, at the end of that time, you're going to wake up and look at that and say, wait a minute, that wasn't right. I shouldn't have done that because that's not what I'm about. That's not what I believe to be true. That's not what I want. Somewhere a real faith is going to result in real action. Now, so what should you do about that? Is my motto then, so everybody go out tomorrow and do something to demonstrate that you're a believer? No, you can't do that. I mean, that would be back to the old, I'm going to go out and earn my salvation grind again. That's not the point. And the way I think about it for myself is the student can't write his own midterm. You can't construct your own test to see whether your faith is real or not. What James is saying is, you're going to come to those places in life where you're going to have to decide, do I really believe this or not? Something's on the line. Maybe you heard the little story I told before the teaching time about how much I wanted to be a filmmaker when I was younger and how significant it was to me that I didn't get to do that. This was exactly one of those places for me where I had to confront the question, do the promises of God in the gospel mean enough to me that I would continue to follow him and trust him when it has been made clear to me that he will not give me what I want in this life? I want this, he won't give it to me. That was a place where the intellectual assent to the truths of the gospel, I had to act on them. Do I really believe this God? Do I really believe that he's on my side the way he says he is? Do I really believe that he loves me the way he says he does? How could he love me when he won't give me what I want? I couldn't ignore those questions anymore or treat them as academic issues. I had to confront them myself in my own heart. What do I think about this? And in essence, that's what James is saying, is that ultimately the faith is something that we have to confront ourselves in the world that we live in. And when we confront it, it's going to ultimately affect how we live. I can evade it, I can ignore it, but ultimately, if I never face into the question, is this true, is this real, is this what I want, then the question really arises, well, then what do you want? What is it that you believe? So James and Paul fit together very well. James is not contradicting Paul in the slightest. Paul says, you need to believe the gospel. And James is saying, you know that belief in the gospel that Paul says you have to have? That's the kind of belief that comes from the heart that ultimately affects the way you live. We could go and look in Paul's letters and find the same theme. Paul believed that too. What you believe affects the way you live and what you do. And we can see the message of James to be one of grace, like Paul. He believed as well that it was God's mercy and justifying us on the basis of our faith and not on our earning our salvation. James and Paul agree on those things. Paul is emphasizing to those who are listening to the legalists, don't get this idea that you can earn your salvation. James is talking to people who have basically blown off the gospel even though they give lip service to it. And he's saying, don't think that faith is a thing that you can just do with your mouth and not live out in your life. If you're not living it out in your life, I would like to ask the question, he says, is there any faith in there at all? Okay, so that's a big topic. And we're going to stop. Right, it's time for questions now. So we're not going to take a break or anything. But if anybody needs to leave, this is a good time to do that. And I'm ready for whatever questions anyone might have.
Kind of quick questions here, I guess.
Great.
This testing seems like, it is, I think, can be a really sort of terrible thing to go through at times, depending on what the test is and what it's involving in someone's life. And yet earlier in the book of James, James is saying, rejoice,
right.
Be happy.
Right.
It's kind of like the rejoice in the fact that you're going through hell right now.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I guess I'd like you to comment on that. And the second question is it possible for a true believer to be confronted with a really major sort of crux issue kind of test in their life and fail that particular test and still end up on the other side of that failure being a believer.
Right. Does it seem a little hot in here? If anybody wanted to open the window a little bit, that probably might work. The first question Tucker asked about in chapter 1, James says, consider it all joy when you encounter various trials. And he's echoing language that we find in Paul and Peter as well. The strange thing, be happy in the midst of trials, in the midst of tribulations. We're going to talk about that passage, in fact, I think, in this series somewhere along the line, if I remember correctly. What you have to understand is, but maybe a good picture is the one that Peter uses, where he talks about like gold tested in the fire. It's not that the fire itself is a desirable or pleasant process, but the fact that you would come out the other end having been tested and you could see the reality of the faith. It's like the gold that has emerged. Wow, there's real gold in there. It's that which he is saying to rejoice in. The grounds for rejoicing is not in the pain that is encountered in the midst of trials, but in the desirable outcome, which is to know myself as a believer. It is desirable. It is something. It is a great kindness of God, ultimately, to shake me to the point where I come to know that there's something unshakable inside of me. I mean, that's a tremendous thing. So that's the grounds for the joy. It's important we understand that, because a lot of people take those passages and I think try to make of them something that is impossible to live with any reality or sincerity over any length of time, which is basically, whenever something bad happens to me, I'm not going to suffer, I'm going to enjoy it because God, you know, I'm supposed to rejoice in my trials, so somehow I'm going to smile through every hardship and no, I'm fine. I'm fine. You know, it's okay. It's interesting to notice that that's not the way Jesus responded to suffering. In the garden, when he faced the death of Lazarus, he wept. In the garden, when he faced the great trial in front of him, you know, he's sweating blood and he's asking, I know, please don't take this away, if it be your will, but nonetheless, I don't want to do this. He was very unhappy. And there's nothing, obviously, there's nothing sinful or unbelieving about being unhappy in the midst of trials, or Jesus wouldn't have been that way. But what it is calling on me to do is to recognize that the outcome is good. The outcome is desirable. I would rather enter into the eternal kingdom of God and to know something of myself now that I am one that is headed that way, than to go through a comfortable life, you know, having everything groovy and then end up, you know, hitting the wall when the judgment of God comes. I want to know, let's deal with it now. Let's deal with these important things now. That's why that's a good thing. But we are not being called upon to try to deny that we are in pain when we are in pain. And frankly, I think Christians who try to do that are setting themselves up for something really impossible. And those of us that counsel other people to try to live in that way are really putting a burden on them that is impossible to bear. I mean, we don't want to do that. So that's how I'd answer your first question. And I think we will talk about that passage more on another night. Now, the second question about what happens if you, in essence, kind of flunk the trial while you're going through it. Abraham is a great, great model of faith. And it is significant. I mean, the tremendous decision he made in that situation is worthy of And we should look at that and marvel and say that was a wonderful, amazing thing that God did in the life of Abraham. But the fact is that when you look at the rest of Abraham's life, it's not that he was always so believing and trusting. I mean, you know, he several times he lied about his wife because he was afraid he was going to get killed by the people in the place he was coming into. When you look at some of the other people of God that we see in the Bible, I mean, wouldn't we say that the episode with Bathsheba, with the King David, if we call that a test, didn't he flunk that test? I mean, he flunked that test really bad, in a sense. I mean, he stole another man's wife and arranged for him to be killed to hide the fact. I mean, that's not good. You know, that's not a good thing to do. But see, the story doesn't end there. The story has its culmination, I would say, when the prophet Nathan comes to David, tells him a story about a guy who's a rich man who steals the one little sheep that this poor man has. And David gets incensed and says, you know, oh, we got to do something to this guy who would do such a terrible thing. And then Nathan points a finger at him and says, you're the man. You are the one who did this. And David hears it, takes it to heart, realizes that he had done this terrible thing, stops trying to hide the reality of it, and repents, confesses that he has been in the wrong, and writes a couple of powerful psalms about his sinfulness and about his confessing that he was in the wrong and the terrible thing that he'd done. I'd say that ultimately David, that trying period of his life, he ultimately passed in the important sense. He showed himself to be a believer. He showed himself to be a sinner, but he showed himself to be one whose heart was open to God, that he could see the wrong that he had done and that he would look to God for forgiveness and so on. So experience would tell me that most of the trials we go through are not nearly as clean as the one that Abraham went through. It's sort of the model, but Abraham, you know, he basically hears this, he acts on it, they go right up to the top of the mountain, it's all over in, you know, a comparatively short amount of time. But for some of us, I think, our trials can extend over years, where we're struggling with an issue or a set of issues. And the fact that right now it doesn't look so good, I mean, if you were to look at decisions I've made along the way, some of them look pretty unbelieving. That doesn't tell the end of the story, because this is, I'm being sorted out. And it's the ultimate outcome of it. Do I finally bow the knee to God and say, you know, you're right, I'm wrong? Do I finally bow the knee to God and say, I should have been trusting you, but I wasn't, and you know, that sort of thing. Failure in a test, failure under trial in the sense that I do things that I ought not do, I think is just probably, for most of us, it's a part of the process. My first reaction is a bad one. And then I'm sort of brought up short, and I have to wrestle with that and say, well, yeah, but what am I going to do with this? Where am I going to go? So, no, I don't think it's a one strike and you're out kind of thing. Some of the most mature, strongest Christians that I know, I think, have become that way through a process that took them through a lot of folly and error and sin. I mean, they had to make a lot of mistakes before they finally got it, what the thing was about. So, Damien?
So, in a sense, to use Tucker's language that you were using about can a believer flunk a test and still come out a believer on the other side, it sounds like what you're saying is that ultimately real believers don't flunk the tests.
Yes, but we have to understand what the real test is. The fact that I'm sinning and failing along the way morally is not the end of the story. I mean, there's ultimately, where do I go with that? Do I admit it? Do I see it? Do I turn from it? Do I look for forgiveness? Do I look for deliverance? I mean, ultimately, yeah, I'm not going to flunk, but we need to be careful about how we define flunk. flunking.
So that the idea isn't so much, say, someone with a particular area of weakness of sin in their life that God keeps kind of, you know, jabbing the knife, twisting it in that particular area, and after, you know, giving into the sin over and over again, gradually they get tough enough and they stop giving into that sin. But that's not so much the salt, the passing, eventually passing the test, but that it may, in fact, and probably is more like they may, in fact, not actually completely ever overcome that sin in their life. But at some point, they're brought to their knees and say, "God, you're my only hope."
Yeah,
yeah. I am pretty convinced at this point. The way I would put these two things together, that I mean, all of us, if we look at our lives, would find things about us that are not the way they ought to be, and may not have been the way they ought to be for some time, and may not be the way they ought to be for some time to come. I mean, I think it's true of all of us. That in itself is not an indication that I am a child of the devil, that I am not a believer, that I don't belong to God. But in the midst of all of that, am I coming to embrace the truths of the gospel? Do I look at myself and am I willing to admit, this is not good? This is not the way it ought to be. Am I looking to the cross of Christ for mercy and saying, I see why you needed to die on the cross, because I'm a mess and I really need this? Am I striving against it because this is not what I want out of my life? Am I looking to God, hopefully, with confidence that He can deliver me and will deliver me from all of the sin in my life ultimately, and I need to hang in there with Him over for the long haul? That's a mature faith, I would say. A faith that has come to the place where it could say, I really am a sinner, I see what I need, I want what God has promised, I'm going to hang on to His promises no matter what comes my way, no matter how bad it gets, even no matter how bad I get. I'm not giving up, I'm clinging to this. That's a mature faith, I would say, in terms of the Bible, what the Bible describes. Not that we want to be blasé about sin, but I would argue that we have to be realistic about what sin is. If we start to really paint the big picture of what does it mean to be a sinner, then we're not just talking about, you know, this is what the Pharisees did. Okay, it says don't commit adultery. I haven't committed adultery. I must be a good guy because I haven't committed adultery. And that's why Jesus had to come along and say to them, yeah, but what are you thinking about? I mean, that because he wanted to make it clear how deep and broad a picture of goodness really would be. I mean, we're talking about something monumental in its integrity. And when you look at that, you realize how unmonumental we all are in our integrity and how sin is very much a part of our experience. I mean, every day is a part of our experience. When somebody needs something from me and there's this little resistance in me because I'm more interested in me than I am in them, that's sin. That's evil. Jesus wasn't like that. I am. And so in that sense, I mean, sin is a part of our experience all the time. I mean, the more we come to see what it really looks like. So that reality does not call into question my faith. It calls into question my candidacy for sainthood, I mean, in the, you know, in the exalted sense. But it doesn't call into question my candidacy for sainthood in the biblical sense. The saints, as it's described in the Bible, are not those who are perfect. It is those who have been forgiven and whose hearts are set on the things of God. That's what the saints look like. And we come to be those kinds of people partly through the process of maturing and struggling and being tested and so on. So it's not all at once either. I mean, and James is not saying that it's all at once. What he is saying is, you know, it looks real bad, you guys. You don't seem to understand at all the stuff that you say you believe. So He's calling them to look at themselves seriously and ask, do you believe this or not? Is this what you want or not? Bill?
So is how would you look then at with the whole story then of Ishmael? Is that one of these, you know, midterms that he failed?
You mean the fact that he slept with his wife? Yeah. Well, see, that was the comment I was going to start to make and didn't while I was talking there, that it's kind of debatable. I'm not sure how to think about that. It's very easy to say, most people say, and I'm perfectly willing to go here, that Abraham was being faithless in doing that. That is, God had promised that he was going to have a kid from his own body, and instead of waiting for God to fulfill that, he took an immoral act, committed an immoral act, and took it into his own hands to try to bring this about. And so that's often given as an example of Abraham's imperfections and lack of faith in that situation. That could be, but I don't know. It's not described that way in the text. And the practice of, as I understand it, of a barren wife having a child through a servant, this was not a strange new idea that Sarah got. This was what used to happen. So I'm not so sure that Abraham was being this faithless, oh, God's not going to do it, I'm going to have to make this happen myself. It's possible that he was just going along with his wife saying, well, okay, maybe this is how this is going to happen. You know, that seems like a good idea. You know, this is what everybody does, so let's do that. The text doesn't say, and I'm not sure at this point which it is. I'm willing to be convinced either way. If somebody wants to make an argument for me that would tell us, I'd be willing. You know, I'm interested in the question, but I'm not. I can't decide at the moment. I'm just not sure.
It struck me as wrong and faithless, but what was interesting to me is that God did not directly rebuke him, but he did clarify, not Ishmael, Isaac. And I don't know, I thought that was really interesting that God didn't come down hard on him for that.
Yeah. Well, see, what's clear to me is that in terms of the story, what's important is this progression of ideas. Okay, he's got a promise, but he's told nothing about how it's going to come about. So his first question is, how? I don't have any kids. So then he's told, you are going to have a kid. And then, however we interpret his action at that spot, he has a kid. And so now he says, okay, I've got the kid, right? This is it. And then God comes along to clarify it more. No, something essentially miraculous is going to happen here. Your barren wife is going to have a kid. So the child that is going to fulfill my promise is going to be just what you would have wanted but never expected could happen. It's going to be a child of you and your wife. A real, honest-to-goodness child coming from you and your wife is going to be the fulfillment of this promise. And so it's like God is moving from a very vague to a more and more specific promise until he gets down to the spot where he makes it clear that Isaac is the one. So in terms of the story, I think the importance of the episode with Hagar is partly this progression of this further and further clarifying to Abraham how specifically God is going to fulfill this promise. I'm really willing to go that direction, that there was something essentially faithless about what Abraham did there. I'm just not sure at this point. I'm not sure if in a narrative, a lot of times, I mean, many of the things that I've said about this are not said explicitly in the Genesis text. It's following the story and seeing how it comes together together with the commentary that we have in the New Testament about it. That's what's so interesting, is the commentary in the New Testament is saying some specific things about what's happening in the Old Testament story that the Old Testament story itself does not explicitly say. It just tells the story. It's kind of like it tells the story and it steps back and says, "You get it?" And you kind of go, "Well, I don't know." And you go and you look at the story over and over again. And then the New Testament authors come along and they say, "Well, it was about this." And they go, "Oh, all right." And then when you go and look at the story, you can see, "Well, yeah, that's right. It was about that, wasn't it? That's exactly what it was about." So that particular part of the story where Abraham has the child through Hagar, nobody much comments on that. Except for Paul in his bizarre allegory that he constructs in Galatians about how Hagar represents Mount Gerizim and, you know, Mount Sinai, I guess, is the way he does it there. So, if there is enough evidence in the story to tell us what the attitude of the author was about what Abraham did at that spot, I can't find it. I'm not sure that I can read it.
It seems to me like, in this I'm sure is probably reading into it some, but where in the beginning Abraham's given his promise and he disbelieves it. So says, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then eventually he gets to a point in his belief where he finally says, at some point he's kind of saying, well, I can imagine Sarah coming to him and saying, "How about this as our solution here?"
Right.
And he'll go, "Oh, why hadn't we thought of that?" Mm-hmm. That must be exactly what God wants us to do.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially that being a kind of moment in his faith where he suddenly starts saying, "Oh, I get it. God got us to a certain point, but now we've got to do something on our own. Now we got to take care of this," and then God comes in and says, "No." You know, in clarifying it, He's also saying, and also what I'm wanting to say to you is that I'm still the one who's doing this.
Right, and that seems to me a very important part of what's happening. I'll just make my last comment about that. Whether Abraham did something wrong in having the child with Hagar or not, what's clear is when God comes along and clarifies it, part of what he's saying is, no, you thought you had got this all arranged, but I really am going to do this thing. I'm going to do this. This is a big deal thing that I'm doing here, and you have not solved the problem yourself with your little attempt to have your own kid here. I'm going to do what I had always intended to do. The thing that you could, this is not something that you're able to pull off yourself. You have a very old and barren wife, and that is not a situation that usually produces children, but I am going to ensure that it does. And so, in that sense, it's meant to show how much, I think of it as being very similar to like when Moses comes back to the Israelites to lead them out of Egypt, at first things are worse. You know, God deliberately sort of makes things worse to demonstrate how much in control he is and to make it clear, to make an object lesson. And in that sense, the whole story with Ishmael and that is part of God's object lesson to Abraham. No, I'm really doing this thing. This is something I'm doing. Was there?
Yeah. I think it's also very significant that God did not necessarily forsake all his promises just because there was this other son.
Mm-hmm.
He did not necessarily remove Ishmael from the promise. There's certainly, very many Arabs in the world, and, part of the story of Hagar and Ishmael is that there was this extended promise. Sure, your son also will be made into many nations.
Right.
I was thinking, too, the first verse in chapter 12, "Go forth from your country." He did that.
Right.
It was, maybe that, if that was like the beginning of his, maybe even having heard from God directly on what to do.
No, that was.
I would assume that's
That was hard.
Oh, yes. And that was an act of faith. I mean, it's clear that you could give that as another example of something that Abraham did that showed his trust in God. In fact, I think the author of Hebrews in chapter 11, before he comments on... verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance.
In a way, that could be harder, because that's an active faith or active works coming out of his faith, where the other one was passive. When he tried to do something, it wasn't that exact way.
Right.
So maybe that's like we are. I mean, sometimes if the obedience is to do something, it's almost easier than just not to do something.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it can go both ways. Mm-hmm. It can be hard one way and hard the other way. It can just be hard sometimes. Did you have one more question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let's make this last one. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more when you were saying, you know, so do I go out and do something that demonstrates that I'm a believer, and you said that the student can't write his own midterm. For me, I mean... help me think about this, because one of the things I struggle with is, okay, I just want to have, you know, the faith that's after, that's post-Isaac.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
You know, I don't want to go through the fire.
Uh-huh.
You know, I kind of think, okay, I'll just get there without the fire.
Right. Well, we always try to make that deal with God. God, hey, I understand, you know, if I agree up front that that's true, can I just avoid... Yeah, he doesn't.
That's why we study the Bible.
That's right.
We've
right.
Faith.
That's right.
That's right. So how do we think a little bit more clearly about that? I don't know.
That doesn't work. that is my answer, but you help me understand. What sort of an answer could I give that would help to clarify that?
I don't have the wanted to be the filmmaker experience.
Right.
God forbid I haven't lost one of my children yet.
Right. Well, here's what I would say. Yeah, when I'm on this side of things, it's hard to think of God as, you know, why would God want to make me unhappy? I mean, I don't want to go through anything like that. If I understand the dynamic of this stuff at all, it seems to me that what's true is that we are, even as believers, someone who is a genuine believer, we are still very much self-deceived. That is, we would still, as much as possible, like to construct reality in our own image and make things as much like the way we want them to be as possible. And God... which we should be tremendously grateful for, is not at all willing for us to do that. It's not kindness on his part, ultimately, to let us live in a destructive fantasy world.